If you could take a seat, that'd be great. We're just going to get started. Good evening. Welcome to VoteWise, which is what I hope you're here for. With the general election looming swiftly, and I'm guessing some people who may already have voted via postal votes, which I think the deadline was for today. So well done you, and well done for still being here. My name's Ellie Maffitt. I'm a member of the church family at Emmanuel Westbury, and I'm sort of hosting this evening, whatever that might mean. Just a few notes of introduction of particularly what we're not going to do. And the first thing, which may be a disappointment, we're not going to spend this evening telling you how to vote. So if you would like to leave now, feel free to. That's absolutely fine. But that is not going to be the outcome of this evening. We're also not going to do a sort of theology of politics, although we'd really love to do that. There just isn't time. It's quite a complicated thing. There's plenty of resources that are on the sheets that are coming around that will help you with that. And if you really, really want to do that, maybe we can persuade Ed and Julian to do a theology of politics when we don't have a general election looming. You know, put that out there. What we do hope we'll be able to do this evening is just help together think through some of the issues and learn how to think through some of the issues together. And hopefully that will then fuel our prayers, most importantly, for this election, for politics generally, for our country, and hope maybe help us to know how to vote on Thursday, even if we're not going to tell exactly what that looks like. At this point, I'm going to invite Julian and Ed up. Doing it first. Tell us who you are and why this matters to you.
Hi, is this on? Yeah. Speaking to that one, thanks. Hi, my name's Julian Rivers. I'm in my day job, Professor of Jurisprudence at the University of Bristol.
Jurisprudence,
you don't need to know about at the moment. Among other things, though, I teach constitutional law, and that's a bit more relevant when it comes to politics. So Ellie asked us, you know, why does this matter to us? Why am I standing up here? It matters to me for all sorts of reasons, some of them probably quite bad reasons, like personal self-interest. But I think it does also matter to God, and that is important, isn't it? I was thinking about this earlier on today, and I was reminded of the Old Testament book of the prophet Amos. I don't know if you know Amos, but it's all about politics. Amos starts off with God saying how much he hates the fact that the nations around Israel have broken their international treaty obligations and committed horrendous war crimes. And then it comes to Israel herself, and God says he hates the way rich people are abusing poor people, the profit they're making from economic oppression. And he hates the way that men are abusing women sexually. And above all, God says in Amos, he hates the way they gloss over all of that with religious sincerity. Amos says a day will come when God will sweep all of that away, and then, here we go, here's the lovely verse, Amos 5:24. Then justice, God's justice, will roll on like a mighty river, righteousness like a never-failing stream. See, God cares about justice. He cares about righteousness. And those are not simply grand ideas in the Bible. They're practical. So he cares about good government. He cares about just laws. God cares about politics, and I think that means we should as well.
I will go here as well. My name is Ed Shaw. I am the pastor of Emmanuel City Centre, but really I'm on a gap year before I go into my career in politics. That's what I was going to do as a 21-year-old. I was going to work for a church for a year, and then I was going to go into politics, and by now, well, you know, where would I be? In the cabinet, probably? I mean, who knows? But that was my plan thank you. That was my plan in my 20s, and who knows what the future might hold in store for me. But why am I here? What am I? I've always cared about politics. One of the most exciting evenings of my life was the 1992 election, which was the first election I stayed up all night for. And if you were staying up all night as well, you'd have realized it was one of the best elections to watch. just for the sense of excitement there was in that evening. Not necessarily a good result for some people in the room, but it was an exciting night, and ever since, I've been hooked on politics. But also, Genesis 1 verse 28 says this. This is God speaking to the very first people he created. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground." When we do politics, whether it's voting or getting involved in politics, we're doing what God asked us to do right back at the very beginning. So that would be a more fundamental reason why we should be involved in what we're doing, what we're talking about this evening.
Thanks, team. On the screen in a minute and on your sheets of paper, I think, is a phone number to text in with any questions. But let me just explain a little bit about how we're going to do questions this evening. We won't have a sort of full-blown time for questions, partly because it takes a long time and could get us quite complicated all over the place. But I'm hoping to be able to put a few questions to Julian and Ed sort of along the way, particularly any questions of clarification or just something that's been misunderstood or anything like that, or big gaps that we may have left or anything like that. So please do text in your questions. It's not to say other questions aren't important, they really are, but we're just working out how best to use the time that we've got this evening. And with all that in mind, I'm going to pray, and Julian's going to kick us off in a minute. Father, thank you so much that you are a God of justice, a God who cares about the governments of this world, what they do, what the impact that has on people and on your people. Lord, we pray, please, would you help us tonight to be like you, to be people who care. People who long for justice. And please help us to think about this all, looking forward to that day where justice will roll like the river. Father, we pray for Ed, for Julian, for others tonight. Please help them to speak well. Please help us to listen to the glory of the Lord Jesus Christ. Amen. Julian.
Thanks, Ellie. So my job in the next 25 minutes or so is to try and give you a sense of the national picture and the local picture. So very factual, just to bring us all up to speed as to, you know, where we're at. And then I'm going to finish by touching on what is not the elephant in the room, which is Brexit, which is arguably the biggest issue. Once I've been up for about 25 minutes or so, Ed will come and talk for a bit. Then we'll have, I think, the Q&A or the response to questions that Ellie mentioned, and then we'll move on to something else, particularly prayer. So if we can have the first slide. There is a guy who I used to know as a student many years ago who's a bit of a whizzy statistician called Martin Baxter, and he runs a website called Electoral Calculus, which uses all sorts of clever statistical analysis to try to predict the outcome of the general election. Here is what he was saying this morning. He reckons that the most likely outcome is that the Conservatives will be returned with a majority of 46, and there you see the table. An increase of 30 seats on the 2017 election result for the Conservatives, a loss of 37 for Labour, slight gain for the SNP of 6, and a few small adjustments elsewhere, but otherwise much the same. Now, next slide. That is obviously a statistical prediction based on opinion polls over the last week, about 10,000 people. It could be massively wrong. So here are his estimates of how likely he is to be right in his prediction of a Conservative majority. He reckons that there's actually about a 70% chance that we will have a Conservative majority government on Friday morning. It's possible, of course, that the Conservatives won't gain a majority, but they'll still be the biggest party in the House of Commons, as they are at the moment. He reckons that's about an 11% chance. There's next to no chance of them doing a deal with anybody. You may have picked that up, that none of the other parties are particularly interested in that, so that's a very small 1% chance. Well, what about the other possibilities? The possibility that Labour actually win the general election? Well, he reckons that's quite small, only a 2% chance now given the polls over the last few weeks. But they might still be in a position, strong enough position, to form a coalition, perhaps with the SNP, with Plaid Cymru, or possibly form a minority government. And he reckons that's about a 16% chance. So there we've got just some sense of the likely outcome, the uncertainties involved. We really don't know yet what we're going to wake up to on Friday morning, particularly as the BBC were reporting earlier today, 20% of voters have yet to make up their minds. That's an enormous swing factor. So the next few days we'll see a lot of hard campaigning by the parties nationally, and Thursday is, as they say, the only poll that counts. Now, what I'm going to do now is whip through the constituencies in Bristol and the Bristol area, just so that you get a sense of the political map. Of course, there isn't really one election. A general election is 650 mini-elections. Each constituency has an election, and there is only one winner in each constituency. It's first past the post. So if we go on to the next slide, please. There you'll see the 11 constituencies in and around Bristol. You can probably just make out from the map, one is Bath, then we go to the central Bristol constituencies, two Bristol East, three Bristol Northwest, where we are in Emmanuel Westbury, four down the bottom, Bristol South, five, which is actually quite central, is called Bristol West, where we are right here, Clifton and so on. Then going up a bit, number six, Filton and Bradley Stoke, seven over to the right is Kingswood, eight down the bottom, surrounding Bath, is Somerset North East, nine to the left is Somerset North, 10 up the top is Thornbury and Yate, 11 is Weston-super-Mare. I call this the constituencies in the Bristol area because we don't use the word Avon anymore in Bristol, do we? So next slide, please. I'm going to go really fast now, but it just, I hope, give you a sense of where we're at, and I'll summarise the headlines at the end, so don't worry if you don't catch everything. This is Bath. We're a Hobhouse. The Liberal Democrat is the MP. She's likely to win with a slightly increased share of the vote. When I say things like that, likely to win and so on, I'm drawing on the data generated by electoral calculus, yeah? Likely to win with a slightly increased share of the votes, that's likely to be 49%. The Conservatives are the nearest contenders. They have about a 1 in 7 chance of taking Bath. Labour, Brexit and an independent candidate are also standing. Next, Bristol East. Kerry McCarthy, the Labour MP, is in the seat there. She's likely to win with a considerably decreased share of the vote, still win, but losing a number of votes at about 46%. Conservatives are snapping at the heels there, the strongest contender. They have about a 1 in 3 chance of taking that constituency. Liberal, Democrat, Green and Brexit are also standing. Here we go, Bristol North West. Several of you might live here. Darren Jones, new Labour MP, who won a slightly surprising win at the last election over Charlotte Leslie, is likely to win again, but with a reduced share of the vote, 46%. Conservatives are very strongly contending here, probably about a 2 in 5 chance of them taking this seat. The Liberal Democrats and Greens are also standing. There is no Brexit Party candidate, and that's slightly odd because the Brexit Party intended to field candidates in every constituency where a Conservative was not defending the seat. This is a Labour-held seat. Why are they not there? The Brexit Party candidate withdrew at the last minute for family reasons, and they couldn't replace him. This is also a bellwether constituency. A bellwether is a sheep whom all the other sheep follow. Typically, this constituency goes with the government. Not always, absolutely, but typically. So if we get a Conservative majority government, you're likely to see a Conservative coming in here. If we stay with a Conservative minority, Darren may keep his seat. On we go. Bristol South, Karen Smith holds this for Labour. She's likely to hold it with a substantially reduced share of the vote, 45%. Conservatives are contending, 1 in 4 chance. Liberal Democrats, Brexit and Green are also standing. Bristol West, here we go. Thangam Debonair, Labour MP, has a massive majority, one of the biggest in the whole area, and she's likely to hold on with a slightly reduced share of the vote, 62%. She's in such a strong position, there are really no other realistic contenders. The Liberal Democrats, you may know, withdrew from this seat to give the Green candidate a better chance. Martin's predictions of the Greens are likely to come out with about 19 or 20% of the vote in Bristol West, Conservatives with about 16% of the vote, and Brexit Party with perhaps 2 or 3% of the vote. It's a very volatile constituency. Those of you who've lived here for a while will know that Bristol West originally, for a long time, was Conservative, and then it went Liberal Democrat for a while, well, Labour, and then it went Liberal Democrat, and now back to Labour again. It does tend to bounce around quite incredibly. On we go. Filton and Bradley Stoke. This is quite a new constituency, formed in 2010 out of bits of Bristol Northwest and other constituencies north of Bristol. Jack Lopresti has held it since 2010 for the Conservatives. He's likely to hold on with the same sort of share of the vote, about 50% of the vote, but Labour are contending this. They have perhaps about a 1 in 5 chance of winning Filton and Bradley Stoke. Liberal Democrat, Greens, and Citizens Movement Party UK, whom I honestly I don't know anything about, are also standing in this constituency. Kingswood over to the east. Chris Skidmore is Conservative MP here. He's likely to hold on with the same share of the vote. That's 55%. Labour are the nearest contender, but only with a 1 in 9 chance. They're in quite a weak position in Kingswood. There are also Liberal Democrat, Green and Animal Welfare Party candidates standing. I don't know what the people of Kingswood do to their animals, but it's obviously bad. On we go. Somerset North East. Jacob Rees-Mogg, a name you may remember, the member for the 19th century, unofficially, but officially the member for Bristol North East, is standing. He's likely to hold on with a reduced share of the vote. This constituency has in the past been Labour, so it's not a totally safe Conservative seat. Labour are the closest contender, not very strong at the moment, 1 in 7 chance. Lib Dems are really quite close behind. There's not a lot of difference between Labour and Lib Dem in Somerset, North East. There's also a Green and an Independent candidate. Somerset North, another famous name from senior Conservative politics, Liam Fox is the member here. He's likely to hold on with a similar share of the vote as last time, 52%. Labour is the closest contender, but again, a really small chance, 1 in 12 only. Lib Dems are not far behind them, 1 in 25. That looks much lower, but in practice, actually, the share of the vote in the last election was very similar between Labour and Liberal Democrats, just a bit behind. Thornbury and Yate are up the top. Luke Hall is the Conservative MP. He's likely to hold on slightly with a reduced share of the vote, 50%. Thornbury and Yate has been Liberal Democrat in the past until the slaughter of the Liberal Democrats in 2015. It was held for quite a while. And the Liberal Democrats are clearly the strongest possible contender to the Conservatives in Thornbury and Yate. They have about perhaps a 1 in 4 chance of taking that seat. There's a Labour candidate also standing, but this is another of those seats in which the Liberal Democrat Green Alliance has had some effect. The Green Party withdrew their candidate from Thornbury and Yate to try and strengthen the chances of the Liberal Democrat winning. And finally, Western Supermare, just to do the whole lot. John Penrose, Conservative, likely to hold with a slightly increased share of the vote, 56%. Labour are the closest contender, but they're really quite weak, only a 1 in 11 chance down in Western. There are also Liberal Democrat and Green candidates standing. So the headlines from all of that, and I went really quickly, I apologise for that, but we've got other things to do this evening. All the current MPs are standing for re-election in the Bristol area. They are all likely to be re-elected. No seat of those 11 is considered to be marginal. So the most likely outcome is we will have exactly the same set of MPs on Friday, at least for this part of the country, as we have currently. Darren Jones, Labour, Bristol North West, is probably the most vulnerable. In terms of all of the 11. After him, I would put Kerry McCarthy in Labour in Bristol East, also a bit vulnerable if the Conservatives have a slightly stronger showing than they currently have, but it doesn't take much more for her to have her seat possibly taken for the Conservatives. On the other side of the coin, Luke Hall, the Conservative in Thornbury and Yate, might be at risk from a local Liberal Democrat resurgence. We don't quite know what's going on up there, but if Liberal Democrats locally manage to persuade a number of Conservative voters to switch alliance, he might be vulnerable. And it might just be worth noting that in Filton and Bradley Stoke, Jack Lopresti, the Conservative, might be at risk from Labour as that part of Bristol urbanises and grows. There's clearly been a shift towards Labour over the last 9 years, since 2010, since the constituency was formed, and maybe that shift will continue, but who knows. So those are the headlines. Now, that's really all I wanted to do. I hope that gives you a sense of the big picture. We've got a Labour core in the middle of Bristol. We've got an island of Liberal Democrats in Bath, and the rest is a sea of blue all around. And that type of split between urban and rural areas is, of course, familiar across the whole of the whole of England, particularly. What I want to do in my last 5 minutes or so, maybe a bit more, maybe nearer 10, is to think about Brexit. We decided to raise the Brexit issue first because it is arguably, and I'm going to argue this in a moment, the single biggest issue in the election. But it's also one which, if you know where you stand on Brexit, it probably solves your question of how to vote. And I will then run through what the implications for voting are if you know where you stand on Brexit. So we can kind of do that. And I'm not saying that Brexit is the only issue in this election. I think it's the biggest single issue. But there are, of course, other really important issues, and Ed will be raising some of those in a moment. The basic question behind Brexit, which we don't have time to go into again, you need to get into a TARDIS and go back to the VoteWise we held in 2016, where we went through this at length. The basic issue, as I'm sure you know, is a choice between how we position ourselves in the world, politically and economically, how the UK positions itself. Should we prefer, on the one hand, the security and the constraints of membership in the EU, which is the world's largest political and economic bloc, and it's run on broadly a social market model. So it's based on free market capitalism, but it tries to mitigate the effects of that with quite relatively high levels of environmental protection, worker protection, health and safety standards, and things like that. So the EU is a social market institution. We've been a member of it as it has grown up, and that offers security and it offers constraints. That's on the one hand. Or should we take up the opportunity and risks of relative independence in a global free market? So that's really the big choice. There's a lot more to be said about that, but we can't go into the substance. What I want to do is suggest why Brexit might be the biggest single issue in this election. I think there's a big question about whether the 2016 referendum was constitutionally legitimate. That's a tricky question because we don't have a clear single written constitution. But here are some points. When we engage in major structural political change, we expect what we are changing to be clearly set out, and we also expect special majorities to approve that change. It's not like an ordinary matter of politics. It's so big and so fundamental that we take extra care over that sort of change. If you think about the 2016 referendum, no political party was proposing that we should leave. There was no clear plan. So while it was clear what remaining meant, we didn't know what leaving meant. That's a problem for legitimacy. The second problem is that all of the countries within the United Kingdom have special responsibilities for implementing and delivering on EU law and policy. So Scotland has its own constitutional competence to deliver on EU law and policy, as does Northern Ireland, as does Wales and England. And you might expect, if we were a proper federal state, which we are not quite, if we were a proper federal state, you would expect the individual states to approve the changes, not just the whole lot. And of course, we know two of the countries did not approve the changes. So there's a worry about the majority there as well. That suggests at least a question mark over the constitutional legitimacy of the 2016 referendum. And that's been one of the reasons why I think it's been so contested since 2016. The other thing which I think the benefit of hindsight gives us is the impact of Brexit on Northern Ireland in particular. I think I would put my hand up here and say, back in 2016, when we were doing the VoteWise event, I had not realised, and very few people had realised, the extent to which the peace process in Northern Ireland depends on both the UK and the Republic being both members of the European Union. How you get around that and find alternative solutions that keep the peace process on track is very, very difficult, as we're seeing. And if you go over to Northern Ireland and talk to people there, you can see immediately the tensions that the whole process has created, or opening up of old wounds. Scotland as well is champing at the bit of independence. Boris Johnson has promised, of course, he won't approve a new independence referendum, but in a sense, whether he approves it or not is not the point. The question is whether we can keep the independence genie in the bottle or not, and that is also a constitutional issue. So what will the impact on the United Kingdom be? Lots of reasons for taking the Brexit question really seriously. It's not just about the UK's position in the world, it is also about the UK as a political entity. What I think we must say is that Brexit will not be over quickly. Get Brexit done is simply not true. It's simply not true. The choice we face is either we leave on the 31st of January, and that then triggers a complex process of negotiating the new relationship with the EU. Now, if we want to get that done quickly, we are going to have to agree to everything the EU asks. What they will ask is alignment with their regulatory standards and laws. So if you want to depart from those standards, you will need to take time. You can't have it both ways. So we are going probably to enter an extended period of negotiation. It would be a real surprise if that were done by the end of the coming year. I don't know anyone who thinks that's really realistic. And of course, then there'll be the risk of the no deal departure at the end of next year as well. So it will be a messy and long process. It will also be a very messy and possibly a long process if the Conservatives don't win a majority, because then the outcome is likely to be a new referendum, possibly with renegotiation beforehand or possibly not. And recent polls, if you're interested, are pretty consistently suggesting that in a new referendum, we would split 52-48 the other way. That's going to be very painful if that happens. So for all those reasons, and again, I say, you can think that on balance, the Brexit experiment is going to be a good one, a risk worth taking, it's worth trying and getting it to work, or you can disagree with that and think that actually we're better off staying in the EU where we are. But either way, it's going to be an enormously significant decision, which will overshadow not just the next year, not just the next decade, but probably the next generation. I was talking with a colleague in the law school a few days ago, and he suddenly turned to me and said, "Do you realise, Julian, Brexit's going to be with us for the rest of our working lives?" He's right, I think. He's absolutely right. So that's why I think Brexit probably is the single biggest issue in this election. And if you agree with me, it makes life really easy. Because if you are pro-Brexit, you should vote Conservative. I wouldn't vote Brexit Party. It's almost a total irrelevance, I think. If anything, it will just slightly prevent a Conservative candidate from winning in a Labour-held constituency. So vote Conservative. If you're anti-Brexit, it's a bit more complicated. It's rather important probably to vote Labour, especially where they are vulnerable to a Conservative takeover in Bristol North West, Bristol East, or Bristol South. In Bristol West, here, you could probably vote Green instead of Labour, because Labour's majority is so enormous that whatever you vote won't let the Conservative Party in. So you've probably got a free choice in Bristol West. You should probably vote Liberal Democrat in Bath and in Thornbury and Yate to see if in Thornbury and Yate there's any chance of overturning the Conservative majority. You should probably vote Labour in Filton and Bradley Stoke and Kingswood, and then you could vote either Labour or Liberal Democrat in Somerset North East and Weston Supermare, because again, the Conservative majorities are so large there. And the two other parties are so close that again, it probably doesn't make much difference which way you vote. So as I said, that's not telling you how to vote. It's telling you, if you agree with me that Brexit is the single biggest issue and you know where you stand on Brexit, then I think the logic just takes you to that sort of position. And that, I think, is me done. And I'm over now to Ed. No, Ellie.
I guess, as you might be thinking, that leaves us with the question, what if you don't think that Brexit is the big issue to vote on, or you think it is, but you still don't know where you stand on Brexit? What do you do next? And how in the world, what are you voting for? Which is where Ed is going to come and help us see what the options are.
Yeah, okay, so if you don't think it's all about Brexit, if you're not already, I mean, I suppose some people probably can go home at this point, but you might want to stay on and find out just some other sort of things that might help you determine how to vote on Thursday. And the options are going to come up on the screen, because at one level, we are voting in a general election, we're voting for a party, we're voting for a policy, but actually you could break it down and say, you could look at this election in a number of different ways. And the way that you choose to look at this election might well help you determine how you're going to vote. If, like me, you're in a bit of a logjam and I really have not got a clue how I'm going to vote on Thursday, you might find that just sort of as we're looking at this election in one of these ways might just begin to help you to work out what you're going to do. Are you voting for a local MP, a political party, a prime minister, a political outcome, or some particular policies? Making your decision on, as it were, what you're voting for might lead you to determine the particular way you're going to vote. Let me show you how. So if you decide that actually, you know, you're going to take the British representative sort of systems seriously and you're going to concentrate on voting for a local MP, that might really help you work out how you're going to vote. Because you might, as a result of that, actually choose the person above the party. So, for instance, you might be in a constituency where the candidate standing for a particular party actually, as it were, better represents you and your political interests than the wider party. So you might find out that the local Labour candidate is a classic New Labour sort of candidate, and you voted for New Labour, you liked New Labour, and he's not a Corbynista, and so actually that would be a reason to vote that person in as your local MP. Because actually, your political views and their political views as an individual are like that. So vote for them. Them to represent you as your local MP. Or you might just be in the position where actually you think that your local local candidate is a bit of a nutter when it comes to politics, but you really like them. And actually, you were just so impressed about how that candidate or how that MP sort of spoke up for a community group that you're part of, that actually you're going to vote for them as a person. You don't like their politics, but you like them as a person. You like their character. You like how hard they work. And that's going to determine how you vote. Saw an email this week from a local church minister talking about their local MP and just how wonderfully kind this MP had been to him as an individual and his wider church family. How when his wife died, this local MP rang them up to check that they were okay. And there might just be that sort of personal connection or a story like that that you know about your local MP that makes you think, I'm going to vote in this election on the basis of this person who I like, rather than all the policies and the politics. So you might, as it were, resolve the dilemma by choosing to vote purely for a local MP, a local representative. That might be how you can resolve things. You might, though, decide that actually, no, you're going to sort of ignore, in some ways, the personalities. You're going to ignore the individual candidates. You are going to focus your attention on the political party that you're voting for. And you might do that out of conviction. You might be in a really fortunate position where, as it were, you take your own personal political convictions and you look at a party's manifesto and you see that actually there's a really good degree of overlap, you know, well above 50%, as it were, of agreement between you and a political party. Praise the Lord for that moment, because that helps you, doesn't it, work out that you're going to vote. Your convictions overlap with a political party. That is a pretty good indication, if that's more than about sort of 50, 60%, that you should be voting for them. I mean, congratulations that you managed to find that level of overlap with a political party. Go with that. Let that solve the dilemma. Or you might just think, I'm going to vote for a particular political party, not out of conviction, but out of pragmatism. You don't want a certain type of government, and you know that in your constituency, the best way of stopping that from happening is voting for a party that doesn't particularly overlap with your political views, but stops that from happening. You're going to vote tactically, pragmatically. And that might be a way, as it were, of helping you work out this dilemma, to vote out of pragmatism for a particular political party. Or you might just want to sort of vote for a particular party out of a sense of protest. Always fun, isn't it, to protest? This is what I did back in 2015, and I felt really good as I made my protest in the secrecy of the voting booth. Of course, nobody probably registered that X was a particularly solid X this year as a protest, but it made me feel good for about 5 minutes. I wanted to protest by voting in a very different way to how I voted previously, because I was very cross with how the party I'd previously voted for had behaved. And so I voted out of protest against a particular political party. And as you know, nothing happened, did it? I mean, you know, but you know, I did it. And obviously, if enough of us do that, that will make an impact. Sadly, not enough of us did that at the election I did that. So, political party might be one way, as it were, voting just for the political party in all those sort of nuanced ways might be another way of working out where to put your cross on Thursday. You might then just think, well, let's be honest, this is all about choosing the next prime minister. And certainly our electoral system is encouraging us to think like this, more and more of a presidential style of politics in this country. It's not the name of the party that appears on the side of the battle bus, it's the face of the party leader. Go to the party websites, it's all about meet Jeremy or Boris or whoever. So you might just want to say, I'm going to go for that. And actually, I don't like the party, but boy do I like the leader, and boy do I think they will be the best prime minister, and you might let that factor determine things. You like the prime minister, you think they're going to be good for the country, even if, to be honest, you've got not much time for everybody they're leading. Or you might think, actually, I'm going to be rather cunning here. I'm going to choose a prime minister who, yeah, I don't particularly like, but I think they're quite a weak person, and I think that actually when it comes down to it, their policies are going to be driven more by the people around them than the person itself. And actually, because I don't think they're really going to be that effective prime minister, I'm going to vote for them because other people are going to run the country and I like the other people more than the prime minister. Now, that's getting quite sophisticated. You're going to have to know quite a lot about the people around them, but that might be a way of determining things. If you're thinking, my vote's all about the next prime minister, which at one level it is, but at another level, bearing in mind how our political system works, it isn't. Okay, well, how about this one? This might be the most helpful thing. You might make your vote in the hope of getting a particular political outcome. And one way of determining things might be just sort of thinking through, when you wake up on Friday morning, if, shame on you, you're not staying up all night, what is the result that's going to bring you most joy? Or, let's be honest, what's the result that's going to bring you least stress? Just imagine, you know, your response to the news of another 5 years of Boris Johnson, or excitement of a new Labour government, or Joe Swinson, Prime Minister. Just in some ways, sometimes actually just working out what your instinctive response to one of those headlines or an alternative headline actually might help you work out what you really want. Just imagine yourself, what's your response going to be? And it's worth thinking through, you know, if you want a majority government on Friday, if you're thinking we've had enough of this political instability, I want a government that can deliver on its promises, that has, as it were, the votes in the House of Commons to do that, that's going to help determine how you vote on Thursday. That's what you want on Friday, a strong government. It's pretty clear, I think, how you vote on Thursday. But if you want a hung parliament, if you want, as it were, various things to be up in the air, if you want the political parties to have to come together and to do a deal, if you want another referendum, if you want the sort of horse trading that happens when there is a hung parliament and there's minority governments, it'll be pretty clear probably in your constituency how you should vote if you want that to happen. but you might not actually care so much about the big picture. You know, who's in government, whether it's a majority government or a hung government, a minority government. You might just think to yourself, I think this is the time when we need more minority voices in Parliament. So I'm going to vote for a smaller party who doesn't have or hasn't had much representation in the House of Commons up to this point. And I just like the idea of more minority voices in the House of Commons. And that might be how you determine your vote. Again, I've done this in the past. Again, totally. Basically, every strategy I've had in the past, pretty useless, which might take away some of the motivation to listen into me. But, you know, I've tried this in the past, thinking, actually, I don't particularly agree with all that this party stands for, but I like the idea of minority voices being heard. Therefore, I'm going to give them my vote this time around. That might be the sort of political outcome that you want, is a House of Commons where there are more voices than just the usual 2, 3. So you might make your vote in the hope of getting a particular political outcome. Finally, you might want to do your voting on just policy, you know, on what these parties are actually saying they're going to do. And you might, as it were, go for one of the big ticket items, if I can put it like this, the sort of thing that's mentioned on the sort of the homepage of the party at the moment. So you might, as it were, have been persuaded by the promise of 50,000 more nurses to vote for the Conservatives. You might have been persuaded by the promise of better public sector pay to vote Labour. You might be persuaded by the thought of 80% of electricity from renewable sources by 2030 to vote for the Liberal Democrats. You might be passionate about reform of the tax system and so vote for the Green Party. There might just be, as it were, a big ticket item that you love, and that is, as it were, going to determine where you put your cross. Or you might just be a little bit more interested in something quite specific. You might be a voter that in some ways cares less about those big ticket items, and to be honest, thinks none of them are going to happen anyway, and actually go for just something much more specific that just, you know, something that you really, really care about, and other people might not. So you might decide to vote Conservative because they've committed themselves to putting into action the report that the Bishop of Truro did for them about persecuted Christians worldwide. And that might encourage you to vote Tory. Or you might go to the Labour Party manifesto and thinking that it's important that we keep Sunday special, you might think that actually you're going to vote Labour because they seem to be resisting changes to the Sunday trading laws in a way that Christians having sort of encouraged and spoken up for in the past. And that might be why you vote for Jeremy Corbyn's party. You might just say, look, the problem we're in at the moment is all down to the first past the post. That's the biggest thing we need to get rid of. And so I'm voting Liberal Democrats. Or you might think that the best thing that could happen for this country is the disestablishment of the Church of England. And if you do think that, you need to vote Green. Because that is one of their policies, to disestablish the Church of England, to break the link between the Church of England and the state. And if you think that is the big issue facing the UK today, vote Green, because it's in their manifesto. It's one of their policies for a while. I sense that in the room, people don't think that is the widest of issues or the biggest of issues, but it's there, believe it or not. Now, it's worth saying that when it comes to some of the issues that Christians have traditionally cared about most, or things that we've been really bothered about in the past because of a biblical worldview, issues like divorce or sex education or marriage or gender identity or abortion or euthanasia, none of the main political parties' policy statements or actions are especially encouraging, would lead you in any particular direction. Just going through the various sort of statements the parties come up on those sort of classic issues that have in the past helped Christians determine how to vote, none of the main parties make it sort of, is there a really clear case, if you believe in a traditional definition of marriage, or if you want to make sure that the abortion happens less, or if you are against you, it's no longer, it used to be clearer, it's no longer there. And it's probably just worth hearing that when you look at both, as it were, what the parties say, but also what they've done in government over the last 10, 20 years. So if it's policy that matters to you, those things aren't going to help, but perhaps one of the big ticket items will, perhaps something else that you really care about might help you determine what to vote on Thursday. What are we voting for? You might choose to vote for a local MP. You might choose to vote for a particular political party. You might choose to vote for the Prime Minister, who you want in number 10. You might choose to vote on the basis of a political outcome that you have been dreaming of and that you'll be happy to wake up to on Friday morning. You might vote based on some particular political policies. It really is up to you. But one of those things might just have begun to make you think, oh, this is a new way of looking at things. I've been in a little bit of a logjam. Perhaps if I think in those terms, that might make it slightly easier, or that might just get me thinking in new ways over the next few days before you actually get to vote on Thursday. Let me be autobiographical. I've done some work on this morning. I'm standing, I'm voting in Bristol. I'm standing in Bristol West. Wouldn't that be great? It would be easy to know what to vote for there. I'm voting in Bristol West, and I just really don't know what to do. Even as we're working through those categories, I'm still sort of thinking, I'm really not sure what to do. Whereas actually, if I was voting in Bristol North West, used to live in there, that constituency, I think those things might help me a little bit more. So actually, so often, actually, it is the constituency you live in that might make these things harder or easier. If you want to change that, move before the next general election. We're going to move to questions in a moment, but just before we do, let me just wave this sheet at you. You should have picked up a copy as you came in the door. If not, you can pick one up on your way out. And it's just got a number of resources that are out there and available. We've mentioned the electoral calculus website that does all the maths and it helps you to see likely outcomes. It's worth visiting every day, or indeed 3 or 4 times a day at the moment if you're really focused on the issues. Evangelical Alliance, we at Emmanuel Bristol are a member of the Evangelical Alliance. They've got some helpful resources on party policies that you can look at. The Christian Institute has a focus on a number of issues that they particularly care about that might align with issues that you care about, and their page at christian.org.uk might help you. Bristol Cable, which some of us will know about, a local news website, has quite a good locally focused input on the candidates themselves, sometimes asking them questions, getting answers, and a sense of what local people are thinking about particular candidates. And then just taking a step back and thinking about Christians in politics and what we can be praying for them, how we can be supporting them, whether we should be more involved in politics ourselves. The Christians in Politics website is well worth a visit. And here's a challenge to, before the next election, next year or whenever it is, why not read Andy Flanagan, Those Who Show Up, a book that's encouraging us as Christians to get involved in the political process. I've got a really good friend of mine in London who is involved in local party politics, has stood for the local council. Whenever I moan about politics, which I do often, he says, what are you doing about it, Ed? And every time I feel a little bit guilty, this book's reminded me that if I really want to get it, if I really want to, have the right to complain, I probably need to do a little bit more, be a little bit more involved than I am at the moment. I think that's it from me, and I'm going to hand over at this moment to Ellie.
Okay, is someone working? Yes, great. Do you want that? And I think you should stand here, because then you get to face that way.
I'm
Julian, come back up. Where do we start? They keep coming in, sorry. Let's start with where we've just finished. So, Ed, you've read a lot of manifestos this morning. Can we trust any of the manifestos?
No. Not really. I think the most helpful function, Julian probably helps with, the most helpful function actually of manifestos now is quite obscure, in the sense of there's a convention in British politics that if a party has put something in their manifesto, the House of Lords, when it gets to, legislation going through the Houses of Parliament, will not oppose it. So, oddly, that's, I think, probably the most significant thing about the manifestos now, is basically, in our very odd little constitutional system, having something in the manifesto means it is more likely to make legislative process, and the House of Lords, as it were, can't get rid of it. That's what's more significant. Otherwise, I just sort of see them as aspirations, some of which are plausible, some of which are deeply implausible. Actually, some of them actually potentially dangerous. I was reading a really interesting article by a housing expert who was saying, when we're starting to promise a certain number of houses within an improbable time span, what we're going to get is really bad quality houses. So, you know, there's actually some unhelpful sort of commitments being made. So I would see them as aspirations. I'd see them as helpful, indicating what people really want to get done at one level, or actually what they think you really want to hear so that you get their votes. More cynical side coming up.
Julian.
Yeah, I think they're indicators of where the parties are coming from, that their sort of values, what they care about, particularly where there are promises that require large sums of money. I mean, I think we have to take those with a big pinch of salt. And sometimes I think they make promises which actually legally are really problematic as well. So, for example, the Liberal Democrats have suggested that they want to make it possible for the Church of England to conduct same-sex marriages. They don't seem to realise that the main obstacle is the Church of England itself, which in its own internal law has a definition of marriage, which means you can't conduct same-sex marriages. It's called Canon B30. And the only way of changing that is for General Synod to agree. So are they really proposing that the government is going, Parliament's going to override the freedom of the Church to make up its own mind on this issue? I don't think so. So they're just an indicator that that's what they would like to see happen, but realistically it probably isn't going to happen.
Oh, questions are coming in thick and fast now. We're not going to be able to answer all of these. But, Julian, a couple on Brexit for you, of course. Wouldn't reversing Brexit be undemocratic?
Well, it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, there's a sort of assumption, isn't there, that a referendum is the most democratic form of decision, and that more democratic than a decision by Parliament or... I'm just not sure that's right. I think it's really interesting that Switzerland, which has the most experience with doing referenda regularly, has reached the position where they are very clear that they're only ever advisory. They're never going to be boxed in by what a majority says, and they take that as a kind of steer from the populace. So if there's a very strong majority for something, then the legislature in Switzerland says, right, we really have got to take this seriously. People feel strongly about this. But if it's narrow, they go, okay, we're pretty divided. And I think, you know, with hindsight again, with a vote that was as close as it was, one would have hoped that those who are in power would have said, look, guys, we're really split on this. We have to come together. We have to work out some sort of middle ground. And middle ground is not what we haven't got. So I'm not sure that the referendum is particularly democratic. It's an indicator at a particular point of time off the back of a campaign that was singularly unintelligent and ill-informed.
You can follow up on that with Julian afterwards. Actually, Julian, stay up here for a minute. Just a couple of clarifications. Well, I think just making things more explicit. If we have anything other than a Conservative majority government, is a Brexit referendum certain?
Oh, my goodness me. Nothing's
certain.
Yeah, yeah. So I think we can be clear. If we get Conservative majority, Boris Johnson has promised he'll run his deal through Parliament as quickly as possible. They've got candidates who are committed to that. I mean, unless it's extremely narrow majority, I think it's going to run through and we will leave on the 31st of January and then we'll be into the next stage. So the Labour Party have said they want to renegotiate a deal. They want a soft Brexit, and then they put the choice between a soft Brexit and remaining. Is that plausible? I've heard, you know, rumours, people saying in Brussels, that's not going to work. We're not going to renegotiate. So I guess my money would be, if we wake up on Friday morning with a hung parliament, I think we might get the current deal in a referendum against staying. So it will be a choice between, if you like, quite a strong Brexit versus staying in the EU. And that might be a compromise that the parties have to come to if Parliament is hung. But I'm crystal ball gazing here. Nobody knows quite how that will play out.
And there is a possibility that actually you could get another general election before a referendum. So if, for instance, there's a hung Parliament and no parties do any deals with other parties, and if you're a moment, you've probably picked up that they're all sort of hardening their deals and saying, the Lib Dems are saying that they won't go Labour, the Scott Nats are saying they're only going with Labour if there's an independent, you know, all those sort of things. You could then have another general election before you even get to another referendum. We could be here again pretty soon.
Just make it part of our Christmas fun. Julian, just a note on electoral calculus. How reliable is it? The polls were so wrong last time. Why do you...
Yeah, the polls... So there's been a real problem with polling. You've probably picked that up. The pollsters, all the pollsters, have been getting it badly wrong recently. And it seems to be that's something to do with social media, particularly picking up on... trends in voting patterns and ways people are thinking, which just aren't getting captured by phone calls. Who answers the phone? These are phone calls and, you know, doorstepping and so on. You don't get very good data. And the polling companies have been working incredibly hard to try and get better data. And one of the interesting questions, I think, is you know, Friday morning, how accurately will they have been? And it may be that the exit polls at 10 o'clock on Thursday evening will have all the pundits going, you know, open mouth saying, my goodness, we've got this badly wrong again. Who knows? But there's been a real problem with polling. Polling is very, very inaccurate at best, and it's got worse recently. So this is why there is so much flex. What Martin Baxter's done is some really clever statistical analysis that's used by social sciences to take account of all sorts of variables in the demographics of each constituency, like their social class, typical social attitudes, voting patterns in Brexit and other things, and factored them all in to try and do better. We will see on Friday morning whether he has or not.
A couple of questions, Ed, on Christian liberty, religious freedom. What are the parties saying on that?
Well, I don't think any of them saying anything that made that reassuring reading. And actually, some of them are saying really contradictory things. So I, you know, read one party that was saying it is for freedom of belief and faith and religion, and also for you know, the full expression of LGBT rights. But there was no sort of talk through about what happens if you're someone like me, who actually might be somebody who's gay but thinks that it's I should be able to say that gay sex is wrong. There was absolute contradiction just in one sentence in one party's manifesto. They think you can say we're going to promise freedom of expression for every religion and also freedom of expression for every gender identity. And at one level, you can have those together if you're not saying that actually one trumps the other. But increasingly, we're feeling, aren't we, or we're sensing that actually one does trump the other. So it's really difficult, and I wish I could say there was one party that had a clear clarion call to preserve your freedom of speech, my freedom of speech, freedom of religion. I don't think they even understand, there's no evidence in any of the policies that I read that they actually really understand the nuance of the issues.
Are you allowed to say which party that was you were talking about?
I don't know. We make up our own rules. I mean, that was...
it was Conservatives, wasn't it?
No. Well, interesting.
I picked it up from the Conservatives.
Okay, so the Conservatives say that, but Liberal Democrats also said that. So actually, and I suspect Labour probably say something very similar as well. They want everybody to be reassured.
Yes.
I wonder why.
There's lots of questions about particular issues, which we're not going to go into, but do come and grab these guys briefly at the end. But obviously, they do want to go to sleep tonight if they're going to be staying up on Thursday. But last question to land on. Why should I bother voting at all if there's no winning issue to persuade my heart and it might just be lucky dip on the day? We'll both have a shot at that. Join Ed.
I mean, I am seriously considering spoiling my ballot paper for the first time ever, which is, you know, it's something that you'll vote. It will be counted that you have spoiled your ballot paper. It's one of the stats that's read out at the count. You know, a number of spoiled ballot papers. So just to sort of, I'm on your side because I'm thinking about that. But I do think that if I do that, and you can ask me, and I may or may not answer. Is I think I'll be wimping out of actually making the decision and recognising that there is a responsibility and that it's not easy, but I do need to make some form of choice. And I think what's probably going to help me in the end is just going through those factors I sort of thought about and thinking, actually, which of these can I pull out and does it help me to determine what I might do? You know, it's probably worth me probably realising also, if I'm getting too obsessed about it, in Bristol West, there's actually, you know, it isn't that exciting. If you're in Bristol Northwest, you should be having some sleepless nights.
Earlier this year, I heard a story of a young man who is an asylum, has been granted asylum from North Korea, who works in politics in London, and he was out campaigning at the by-election that took place earlier in the year. And he knocked on one of the doors, and he was met with a torrent of abuse from the guy who opened the door about how terrible politics was, and they were all as bad as each other, and it was absolutely rubbish. And he listened for a while, and then he paused and he said, "I'm from North Korea. I think it's really wonderful that you can say this to me." And there is something to be remembered there, I think, that, you know, for all its faults and all the terrible, you know, confusion we've got and the anger, I think, and frustration with politics, at least we have different parties we can choose between. At least we can express our opinions. We can make a decision. So I think even if you feel like spoiling your ballot paper, which I think is a legitimate option, and writing a plague on all your houses or whatever else you want, message you want to get across, at least do that. Don't just sit at home, because it's too precious.